This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Welcome to a special edition of Radio Astronomy, the podcast and the makers of BBC Sky Night magazine. My name is Kev Lotch and I'm joined by Ian Todd. Today we're not in a studio, we're in a field. Ian, where are we?
Yeah, we are indeed in a field. We're at Jodrell Bank for the Blue Dot Festival, which is in its second year. It's a whole weekend of camping and scientific talks and music and culture and art and all sorts of wonderful things.
And Ian, what is that giant metal contraption about 200 metres away from us?
I believe that's the Lovell telescope, the famous Lovell telescope, Kev.
The third largest radio telescope in the world. Isn't it wonderful?
It's absolutely fantastic. What a backdrop.
Ian, why are we here?
We are here to talk to various people and basically soak up the festival atmosphere and hear talks about the origins of the universe.
So we've been behind the scenes talking to some of the scientists giving lectures at this year's festival.
Exactly, yeah. We've heard from Anna Bonaldi, who's working on the Square Kilometre Array, which is going to kind of peer deep into the past and look at the origins of the universe. We've heard from Anna Scaife about giant radio galaxies, which are basically galaxies that are almost too big to see. And we've also spoken to Chris Parks of the Large Hadron Collider about the recent discovery of a new type of particle. Mark McCorcoran from ESA spoke to him about the upcoming BepiColombo mission.
We just had that media day. Very exciting.
Yeah. And perhaps most exciting was Catherine Joy, who spoke to us about meteor hunting in Antarctica, which is...
It was very cool, literally and figuratively. But first, you're going to hear all of those interviews in a bit. But first, we spoke to Tim O'Brien, who's the Associate Director of Jodrell Bank, about the festival and about the work they do here. So I'm sitting with Tim O'Brien, the Associate Director of Jodrell Bank in Cheshire. Thank you for joining me.
That's okay.
We are at the second Blue Dot Festival. Hmm. We're on our second day. How's it been for you so far?
Oh, it's been really good, I think. It's been hectic, of course. You find yourself floating around with your brain sort of slowly turning to mush. But they thought the whole thing's been amazing. I mean, really tried to catch some of the activities here, because when you sort of organising it behind the scenes, you can imagine it gets a bit busy and a bit hectic. So you've got to find the time to chill out and see some of the events. So I think left field was spectacular last night. Really enjoyed them, and then we had this amazing projection on the Lovell telescope. I don't know whether you caught any of it, that was using reinterpreting live data coming from a receiver on the telescope and then projecting it back onto the telescope. So that was incredible.
That's amazing. How do they transform that data?
That's the magic of our Japanese artist that we're working with, a guy called Daito Manabe, who's who's an amazing artist, but also an amazing programmer as well. So he's the fastest Python programmer in the world that I've seen. He's just over his laptop. So he's basically taking, we're streaming him data coming right off the telescope, and he's turning that into both a visual piece, and his colleague Satsuya is turning it into an audio piece that we're playing. And actually, the audience can control it, so they can tune through the spectrum that's being received, and that changes in real time what's on the telescope. So it's unusual to be able to control a 90-meter-high radio telescope in that way.
It was absolutely beautiful. Can you tell us a little bit about the Blue Dot Festival? What is it about? What is its kind of aims here?
Yeah, I mean, For a long time, I've been interested in public engagement with research for many years, and I actually worked with Teresa Anderson, who's the director of the Discovery Centre, the public side of the site here. I happen to be Teresa's husband as well, so it's a bit of a family operation. We wanted to reach out to people who might not otherwise consider coming to Jodrell. So there's been a visitor centre here since the mid-60s. We've had millions of visitors come here over the years. Now we have 180,000 visitors a year. But there's always this sort of worry that you're preaching to the converted, that people who come and visit you are the ones who are already interested in science and they want to find out more. That's fine. We do lots of stuff for people like that. But it's getting to the people who might not ever have considered coming that we were interested in. So this idea of putting both a music festival alongside science and art, you pull in people who are interested in all these things, and it emphasizes that science is part of culture.
It really is.
It's not a completely different thing. It intersects with all these other areas.
Now, of course, we are sitting in the shadow of the Lovell Telescope here at Jodrell Bank. It's a couple of hundred metres away from us. Can you tell us what kind of work you do here on a daily basis when we're not all enjoying science talks and music acts?
Well, I mean, there is a receiver on the telescope right now. It's pointed straight upwards, as you can see. It's pointed more or less at the zenith directly overhead. Because actually we're doing a little bit of maintenance work. We often do big maintenance jobs in the summer when the days are longer, so there's more opportunities to work on the telescope. So it is parked up at the moment, so we're not steering it around looking at individual sources, but we do have a radio receiver on right now, and we are collecting data. And of course, as the Earth turns, this patch of sky that we're looking at directly overhead, it drifts past overhead the telescope. So you end up seeing this big strip of sky all the way around. It's a drift scan. That data we're looking for, there's some pulsars, sort of remnants of exploded stars, spinning remnants of exploded stars that drift through the beam, and we can time the flashes from the pulsars. But we're also looking for these weird things called fast radio bursts, which are a relatively recent discovery. Very brief flashes of radio waves coming, we're pretty sure, from the distant universe, so many millions, if not billions of light years away. And really, we have no idea what they are. They flash, and that flash lasts a fraction of a second. It must be something very small for it to be so brief, because the light travel time across the object would smear it out. Probably some sort of explosion, or perhaps something dropping into a black hole, something like that. But we found there's around about 20 of them been found over the last 5 to 10 years. And so we're just looking out for these unusual things just while we're doing the work on the telescope.
And of course, it is a radio telescope. It's not operating in isolation, though. If I'm correct, it's part of the E-Merlin network. It's like 7 radio telescopes around, is it the country, the world?
Yeah, it's around. So those E-Merlin, yeah, you're right, says is up to 7 radio telescopes. Mm-hmm. So there's the Lovell, there's the Mark II telescope, which is just beyond the hedge there, over the camping field, which is a big telescope in itself, and it just gets... It sort of sadly disappears into obscurity when it's next to the Lovell telescope, but that's an amazing instrument in itself. There's another 5 about that size, about 25 metres, 30 metres in diameter, spread around across England.
And a Lovell is 76?
76 metres, yeah. So they're about a third the diameter, so square that, roughly 10 times less collecting area. So the Lovell dominates in terms of power, in terms of collecting area. But these other telescopes, spread between here and Cambridge, all connected back to Jodrell Bank by optical fibres. Mm-hmm. So they all effectively work as a single telescope. So they're like 7 bits of a giant 217-kilometre-wide telescope. And the bigger you make your telescope, the sharper the view you get. So you effectively zoom in and see the fine detail. So with E-Merlin, with a radio telescope the size of E-Merlin, 217 kilometres across, we basically get the same sharpness of detail as the Hubble Space Telescope gets
in
the optical. And the Hubble Space Telescope, of course, has to be flown above the atmosphere to avoid blurring. So that's its key. It's a sort of really key, unique, actually, in the world, that instrument, to get that level of resolution in the radio part of the spectrum.
I get, one thing you mentioned with Hubble just there is that it has to be flown above the Earth to get those views. Yeah. I mean, with a radio telescope, presumably you have to take measures to prevent interference. Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah, well, in terms of measures to prevent interference, what you're right, there's increasingly large uses of the radio spectrum. So whether it be for mobile phones, remote CCTV systems, airport radars, there's loads of ways in which we use the radio spectrum. And radio astronomers sort of compete for that, really, with everybody else. The sad thing for radio astronomers is we can't really afford to pay for the radio spectrum in the same way as a lot of these commercial users can. So there are little bits of the radio spectrum that are protected for radio astronomy use, and they really are only little narrow bits. They're like national parks for radio astronomers that are protected. So there's a few of those. There's one near the hydrogen line.
Yep.
There's a very famous emission line due to atomic hydrogen in space around about a wavelength of 21 centimetres that's protected. And there are some others, but they're always under pressure. So what we do is, in the case of Jodrell, you know, historically, we're here because Bernard Lovell, who started the observatory at the end of the Second World War, moved away from the city of Manchester to get away from radio interference, came to the country where there were less people, right? And that's why we are here. Obviously, over the years since, there's more and more people, you know, more and more activity, yes, human activity in this region, and so the interference levels have grown. So we're always in that sort of battle, if you like, to try and reduce the level of activity in the region. We take a hit, actually, at Blue Dot for interference.
Yes.
Deliberately, because we balance up the benefit of promoting the science and all the other activities we do here against a weekend of increased radio interference. And we've decided that at that level, given that we're otherwise working 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, it's worth a weekend for the benefits it brings us.
Yes, because I hadn't realised until you said that you were still collecting data right now.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen the signs about mobile phones being off, so it's radio call. I had thought that it would just shut down for that one weekend, but...
Well, we'll do... We will always collect data and we'll do what we can with that data. There's undoubtedly greater interference this weekend than there would normally be with all these people here. You know, there's 10,000 people on site and, you know, there's an amnesty on mobile phones, for example, this weekend. So, but the Mark II telescope is operating. I can see it over there. It's pointing south. It's pointing away from us. So it's away from most of the interference in this case. It's the Lovell that's probably most subject to it, because when it's operating as a single dish, it's not got the advantage of the sort of distributed nature of the array that we have in EMIL, and that allows us to reject some of the interference, local interference, because it's not present in all the telescopes. So the Lovell's most subject because it's most powerful and because it often operates as a single dish. But yeah, we're continuing to observe.
Now, one last thing I want to ask you is, obviously, at the Blue Dot Festival, which takes its name from the Powell Blue Dot image captured by Voyager mission. It's in its 40th year. It's still going. And in a mission of Sony first, I want to ask you, what's its best legacy? What's it?
Voyager.
It's such an expansive mission, and one which is literally rewrote textbooks.
Yeah, you look a bit younger than me. I'm not sure how old you are, but I remember... You know, I remember the Voyager images coming back. You know, I was born in 1964, so Voyager was launched in 77. So I was 13 when Voyager was launched, and we started to get these data back through the late 70s and into the 80s. So I remember those first images of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, the discovery of the volcanoes on Io and things like this. I mean, you know, it's easy to forget, I think, when we are living in the era of Juno orbiting Jupiter. And in fact, on Monday, flying over the Great Red Spot on Jupiter, I'm sure it's going to produce some spectacular images. And Cassini has been orbiting Saturn for years now, about to be crashed into
its final plunge.
Its final plunge in September. And I think, you know, it's easy to forget that there was a time not that long ago when we didn't have any of that. And that, I think, for me, that's one of the key things that Voyager did, was to produce those first beautiful close-up images of those planets, of Saturn's rings, of the moons. And I suppose, you know, for Blue Dot, one of the key things is Carl Sagan's request to turn Voyager 1 to look back at the Earth and take that photograph from a distance of 6 billion kilometres of the Earth, and the Earth comes out as this tiny fraction of a pixel, you know, and that whole idea that the Earth is a speck in space, we're all on it, everyone we've ever known, everyone we've ever loved, everyone who ever, has ever lived is on this tiny fraction of a pixel, and how we need to remember that that's important, and how we need to not only look after each other but protect the planet sitting there, this sort of spaceship Earth concept is something that inspired us here for Blue Dot.
It's such a contrast as well, that image, to the blue marble of the Apollo, where the Earth is so dominant. And you look at it and how they dot.
Yeah. And of course, you know, even that was, you know, remember, think back, you know, the first thing this telescope did in 1957, 60 years ago, it's the 60th anniversary of the Lovell this year. The first thing it did was to track the rocket that carried Sputnik into space, you know, the first artificial satellite. The first pictures of the Earth from space were only possible once we had these satellites. It's not actually that long. You know, we're sitting in the presence of something that was there at the time, collecting those first signals from space. And those first pictures, you know, of the Earth as a globe, and, you know, the oceans and the clouds and so on, that blue marble picture, you know, I think changed radically the way people think about the planet. We didn't have access to that. We're so used to seeing these amazing pictures from space. It's easy to forget that that's all happened within the last several decades.
Well, hopefully Blue Dot and the talks you've got going on here and the workshops will help people to continue to change the way they think about the planet. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm here at the Blue Dot Festival with Anna Bonaldi, who is a cosmologist working with the Square Kilometre Array. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak to me.
Thank you.
I've just listened to your amazing talk, which was kind of about how we can understand more about the beginning of the universe, which sounds quite epic. Can you explain how that's possible?
Well, actually, the universe did evolve a lot through its history from the Big Bang to now, and it left us several clues that we can follow. It is very difficult to understand because it's very distant and it's a very long time, but indeed we have this trail of crumbs that we can follow. One of that is the cosmic background, the first light that the universe emitted, but also we can study all the galaxies and the stars, and in particular the position that they occupy in space, because it is the evolution and the forces that act between the structures that is actually deciding what the structure, the large-scale structure, will look like.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to be able to do this with the Square Kilometre Array. Now, what exactly is that, and how does it differ from, say, an ordinary optical telescope that someone might have in their back garden?
Okay, so there are two main differences. So first, this is a radio telescope. It's not an optical telescope. It means it looks at the kind of light that our eyes are not able to see. It is a much lower energy light. It is similar to what we could look with an infrared camera, but even less energy than that. So they said basically there is probably more energy in a snowflake than on all the radiation collected by radio telescopes so far. So this is to tell how low energy that radiation is. But it is able to travel very far, very, very far, and come to us from very, very far in the history of the universe. So that's a good thing. And then the second reason why it is different is because it's much, much bigger. So the normal telescopes are very much bigger than those that we can have in the garden. And this one in particular is going to be constituted by initially 200 antennas for the mid-array. And when it will be completed, it will be some thousands of antennas. So it's really a massive project. And it will going to be equivalent of having a telescope with actually an aperture, a collecting area of 1 square kilometer. So like if your telescope, the circle of your telescope was 1 square kilometer in area. So very, very big.
And they're going to be built in South Africa and Australia, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Why have those locations been chosen?
Those locations have been selected because of practical reasons initially, which is they are radio quiet. So there aren't a lot of radio emissions nearby. That is going to be a very disturbing signal for our purposes. So this is one of the selection criteria. also these two countries are participating to the projects, and therefore they sort of submitted an application actually for their sites to be chosen, and they were both so good that we couldn't decide between them. And since we are going to build two arrays, we decided the best thing was to use both of them. They host some radio telescope already, so these sites are good now, but also will be preserved. They're going to be radio quiet zones for decades to come.
Ah, so we'll have a nice quiet quiet setting in which to observe?
Absolutely, because it's going to cost a lot of money. So if when we finish deploying the antennas, they decide to put a radio station there, it's going to be a lot of a problem. So we basically went for areas where there already was some agreement, because there are radio telescopes there, that basically no one is going to build anything disturbing our science. And in fact, it is a desert area, so not one close to any city. So it is a reasonable request, let's say, to say, please don't broadcast any radio there.
I think one of the most mind-blowing things with regard to trying to discover what happened at the early stages of the universe is the idea that we can almost look back in time, can't we? The farther we look, the farther in the past we look, is
yes,
that correct?
I'm very pleased that you were listening carefully to the talk. So yes, since light travels at some speed, which is not an infinite velocity, when we look very, very far, for a galaxy very far, we look at as it was in the past. We have to take into account how much time did take to the light to arrive to us. So if we were able to spot a very, very distant galaxy hundreds of light years away, we would look at it as it was when the universe was very different, and still the galaxies were newborn and forming and not the same as we observe today. So this is very important to understand the evolution of the universe. So our aim is really indeed to look very deep. It is difficult to spot them. They are very small, they are very faint. But if we can do that, it is a photograph of the universe in the past. We can make a movie, basically, of the history of the universe.
Is it actually, at least theoretically, possible that we would be able to see the Big Bang occurring? Could we look that far back?
Unfortunately not. The CMB is the first thing that we can observe. It has been mapped already by satellites. The latest one was the Planck satellite. Unfortunately, before the Big Bang, there isn't light produced. And it is light that we are able to see. We can't reach out there in any other way. And we can, of course, model. We can have models of what might have happened to go from the Big Bang to the cosmic background, and there are those models, but there isn't any earlier light that we will actually be able to measure, unfortunately.
Okay, and I think perhaps one of the other most interesting and exciting things is the idea that we might be able to, with the Square Kilometre Array, pick up artificial signals from other planets if there was intelligent life on other planets?
Yes, absolutely. So if from some other planet they pointed at Earth, we are actually broadcasting around a lot of artificial signals with our satellites, with our TV transmissions, etc., etc. So it is very different, this kind of signal, from a natural one, because it has complicated patterns. So it wouldn't be difficult, actually, to understand that it is really a technological civilization. And, you know, what we plan to do with the SKA is to also look for that. The difficulty is that there are a lot of planets. You have first to find suitable solar systems, and then to look for plausible planets, rocky planets, and things like that. And then you have to point there. And the probability to actually hit in the right one seems to be quite low. But nonetheless, it is one of the main objectives, is actually for looking for external planets, for planets with the possibility to host life, and indeed also for artificial signals coming from them. That would be an astonishing discovery indeed.
Definitely. So when can we expect the first data?
Well, the telescope will be operational, we expect, around 2024, taking the first scientific data. The various people in the science community interested in using the telescope will apply for telescope time, as is normal. And there will be several projects. We require a lot of hours, which means they will be carried on through several years. So we will have the first results on those projects that are the more traditional ones, that they require short time, almost immediately. But to have the answer for the biggest and most ambitious project of the SKA, we need to wait some years, because indeed they need to accumulate a lot of data. This is something different that this telescope has from those currently operating, that we are planning those very big KSAGS projects that are going to accumulate thousands of hours of the telescope before releasing data.
It seems like a long time to wait for people who aren't astronomers like myself, but I'm sure it'll be worth it.
It is very short compared to the timescale of the universe. So we need to be a little patient. But yes, I think I am very impatient myself to see this first data.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to it. Thank you very much for talking to me, Anna.
Thank you.
So I'm joined now by Catherine Joy from the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Manchester, and she's also an Antarctic meteorite hunter. So thank you for taking the time to join me.
Thank you very much for having me.
I just want to start by asking quite a basic question. Why meteorites? What's so good about them? What can they tell us about the solar system?
That's a pretty good place to start, because meteorites do tell us about the start of the solar system. So they tell us about the solar system's origins, how we started to build up the small bodies like asteroids that then got bigger and bigger when they collided to turn into planets. And they tell us about all the different types of geological and physical processes in between. So we can study different types of meteorites. There are many varieties. They come in all different shapes, colours, sizes, from different parts of the asteroid belts. We even have some fabulous ones from Mars and Moon as well. But the ones that come from the asteroid belts tell us about different snapshots. So when those bodies were growing, if they never really collided, if they remained primitive, so pretty much all the dust that would have been first formed around the early sun when it got stuck together, and that tells us about the age of the solar system and the sun through that, right through to how the collisions then grew those bodies, and then geological processes, so volcanism, impact cratering, fundamental big scale processes that, short of sending lots of spacecraft to visit the asteroid belts, we wouldn't be able to know anything about.
And unfortunately, those missions are way off yet.
Yeah, so we have had some samples brought back from a Japanese mission, brought samples back from one asteroid, and we think there's two more going. Well, there are two more going at the moment, but they're bringing back, grams, micrograms of material, very small amounts. The great thing about meteorites is we have kilograms to even tons. We have some iron meteorites that are huge. And so, for geochemists and people that work in laboratories, having large amounts of sample mass is great, because it means we can ask the rocks different questions.
The largest sample size I seem to remember was about the size of a basketball from the Antarctic. Is that right?
That was so. In the previous meteorite hunting trips I've been on, the largest one that we recovered was about the size of a basketball, which is pretty big. Most of them were probably about 3 centimeters in size. I think the biggest Antarctic one is probably about a meter in diameter they've recovered, and that proved quite difficult to get back, out of the continent on the back of a snowmobile to ship it back to America to study. But there are even bigger meteorites. So there's one in Namibia, which is meters in size, and that's still in the ground. They couldn't even get it out of the ground.
Oh, wow.
And every day there's even dust-sized particles falling. So we have not meteorites as such, but dust particles that have fallen through Earth's atmosphere, similar processes that are accumulating, and they're down to, the thickness of a human hair, so really tiny.
But that leads me on to something else. Is there a meteorite size that's too small? Would you ever look at one and go, I think I can find one that's bigger?
We always want bigger ones, but no. So no, there are even the very small ones tell us interesting things. So actually, a lot of the dust particles that we collect, the interplanetary dust particles, probably come from maybe cometary origins, or from asteroids that are very friable, so ones that break up easily in the atmosphere. So actually the small ones give us insights to the types of asteroids we have that never would survive large chunks entering the atmosphere. So they're beautiful in their own right, in their own way.
Now, we talked a moment ago, just very briefly touched on the fact you've been to the Antarctic. So you've been twice so far with US ANSMET trips, and you're going once more for a UK-led one in 2018.
Yeah.
So what's so special about the Antarctic? What makes it such a fertile ground for finding meteorites?
So they've been doing systematic missions to Antarctica since the late 1970s. The Japanese teams, American teams, the ANSMET team, and there's been European teams, some Italians have gone down before. And we've recovered about 35,000 meteorites, so a huge amount of samples that have been collected. And the Americans are really great in that they take international scientists with them. So actually, I'm just one of several Brits that have been lucky enough to be selected to go down with them. So there's been people from the Natural History Museum and other UK universities. But looking forward, you know, the UK's never done its own METEOR and British Antarctic Survey service a large part of Antarctica, where we think there are certain regions that are probably going to be quite good for meteorites to move through the ice and to be collected. And therefore, this new funding that my colleague Jeff Everett, who's the principal investigator at the University of Manchester, was just secured funding to go and test an intriguing mathematical hypothesis. So the UK effort, although we're going to find meteorites that are sitting on the surface of the ice, we're also going to take a sneaky peek beneath the ice to see if there are rocks trapped within. And that's not really been done before.
Now, I heard that this UK lab mission is going to involve a landmine detector.
Yes.
Is that what that is?
So we've roped in our friends in the University of Manchester who are in the engineering department, who on a day-to-day basis specialise in landmine detection. And they do, you know, amazing, worthwhile things going out to detect landmines and recover them and develop the technology to improve landmine detectability. Mm-hmm. And given that a lot of meteorites carry iron, they're metallic, we have suggested to them it might be a good idea that they could try turning their device to a different question. And so now they are designing a system that is going to become ruggedized. And by that, I mean that is we're able to drag behind us on skidoos a lot of them. It's going to be a monstrous effort to get this stuff down to Antarctica. And we're going to spend every day driving up and down the ice with these metal detecting devices to see if we can find meteorites that are trapped just with under the surface, maybe down to about 50 centimetres. And the next year and a half, the clever engineers are perfecting this technology and getting it all to work. So that's their bag. And, you know, it's intriguing to see it all develop, and it's very exciting.
But they're going to drag it behind like a plough?
Little bit like a plough, not too dissimilar. So down in Antarctica, there is a lot of science experiments deployed off the back of skidoos, such as ground-penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. And BASS are really good at doing this and taking, you know, complicated scientific experiments, redesigning them, making sure they don't fall apart, making sure that when you're in the cold in Antarctica, you can fix them very easily, because there's nothing worse than you having to take your gloves off and trying to do maintenance in the field. And it's all hopefully going to come together in a beautiful design.
Now, you just mentioned something else I wanted to ask you. You're not actually allowed to touch any of the meteorites you find, is that right?
So, no, because we could potentially contaminate them, particularly with our grubby fingers after not having washed for a long period of time in a tent. No, that's not true. So so we have to use specialised, sterilised equipment to collect all the meteorites. There's a procedure to make sure that they are collected and kept pristine, because some of the science questions we want to address by studying these samples involve analysis of organic-rich materials, which tells us about the volatility of different planetary bodies, and we would like to keep them as clean as possible for that reason. So sterilised tongs straight into a special collection bag, sealed up, and then we don't touch them until we unwrap them when they're back in a clean laboratory.
So there's no analysis at all that takes place out there?
No. That's a really good point. So no, but one of the things we may be trialling is once we put stuff in the bag, there are techniques where we can use the magnetic signature of the meteorites to give us an indication about what type it is. But that can all be done through a plastic bag, so we don't have to do anything in the field.
I see. So when you're out in Antarctica, how long do you spend out there?
So it depends on how good the weather is and right, how good the logistics are. So ANSMET, who go each year, you know, they've had some fantastic field seasons, 6 weeks. Every day they've been out meteorite hunting, recovering samples, and come back with 1,000 in the bag at the end of the field season. Other field seasons, it's just dreadful weather. There's winds, there's, you know, I was going to say rain, there's not rain, there's snow, driving snow, and you don't get a lot of field time. So on the second mission I went on, we got 63 meteorites, which doesn't sound like an awful lot, but they're wonderfully interesting, and they're, you know, those 63, they turn out to be some really good ones, and that's because we had lots of bad weather. So for the upcoming missions, we're not quite sure how long they're going to be yet. That's also in the planning stages, and in part it depends on the logistics and what else is going on in the field at the time, but probably on the scale of weeks. So we'll be there for Christmas, we'll be there for the new year. We'll see the new year in Antarctica.
What's Christmas like in such a remote location?
Cold, no. Cold and windy, as I guess as it is sometimes in the UK. No, if you're working, it's just like any other work day. So we did, on the seasons I went before, I get together with all the other team members and we celebrate in the evening and we all exchange presents. And, you know, we try to, because you're away from home, you're away from family. And so the guys that are on your field team with you are your family when you're in the field. And coming together and having a celebration is a really important thing to do.
I'm just curious, what's the hardest part of a mission like that, both in terms of science and in terms of that human element of being out there?
Yeah, human element, I don't know, I loved it. The times I've been down before, I'm yeah, it was just an amazing experience because you don't have to worry about all the normal stuff. All you have to focus on is getting up, eating, putting your clothes on, not getting cold, eating a bit more and then a bit more, collecting meteorites, repeat until bored. And it's a, you know, it's a really simple experience and you're in the most beautiful place. It is cold. Some days your toes feel like they are going to disappear. Primitive bathroom facilities is always an interesting thing. Keeping clean, you know, baby wipe. It's, you know,
which is why you can't touch the meteorites.
Exactly, which is why you can't touch the meteorites. So there are, you know, washing, actually, you know, the worst thing, not being able to wash my hair was horrific for a long time. So, the first shower you get back into the base is the best thing. And being away from family as well is hard. But you do have a satellite phone, so you can phone home.
Particularly important for Christmas Day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Catherine, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
No problem.
Okay, so I'm here with Anna Scaife, who is the head of the Jodrell Bank Interferometry Centre of Excellence. Thanks very much for joining me at Blue Dot.
No problem.
And we've just come from your talk, which was about giant radio galaxies, but I wanted to just first of all touch upon this word that's in your job title, interferometry. Can you explain what that actually is?
Yeah, so interferometry is where you use the interference patterns from different receivers to make images. And it's very important for radio astronomy. Radio waves are very long. If you don't have a very big telescope, you have very poor resolution on the sky. And interferometry is one of the ways we use to solve that. So instead of making a telescope that's 100 miles across, we can simply have two telescopes that are separated by 100 miles and link them together. And that's the beauty of interferometry.
Okay, so it's kind of the way that like a telescope array works?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And so your talk was on giant radio galaxies, so I guess we should discuss that. What are giant radio galaxies? And are they the same as say, for example, like a nice spiral galaxy like the Whirlpool?
Okay. So the answer is no, completely not. So M51, the Whirlpool, is a spiral galaxy, a star-forming galaxy. It's much more like our own galaxy, the Milky Way. It's the kind of galaxy that you could go and live in. Giant radio galaxies are the opposite. They're very violent, very energetic galaxies, and you don't really want to be anywhere close to the centre of them because they have a supermassive black hole spewing out jets of radio emission.
Okay, so presumably when we look at them, they have a very, very bright center as a result of that radiation?
So in fact, the brightest thing about giant radio galaxies are the jets of emission. So the jets of emission are filled with electrons moving close to the speed of light, and they produce very bright, in radio terms, emission. The central region can actually be quite faint, and sometimes you can't see it at all.
And there was a great moment during your talk when you kind of said, can you see the polar bear? And you showed us a picture of a polar bear, but then you zoomed in on the polar bear's coat and said, can you still see the polar bear? How does that analogy kind of relate to?
So giant radio galaxies can be absolutely huge. One of the new giant radio galaxies that we discovered recently with the LOFAR telescope is so big on the sky, it's twice the size of the moon. And when something is that big, you have to have an equally large field of view to see the structure. And we don't have that field of view normally. So if you don't have the field of view, you just see like, you know, a little patch of the polar bear's coat. You can't tell what the complete form is. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of giant radio galaxies.
So why do we study them? What can we learn about them?
Giant radio galaxies are interesting for a number of reasons. The first one is understanding the evolution of galaxies themselves. Giant radio galaxies are thought to be the last stages of the evolution of these radio sources. And so when we look at giant radio galaxies, we're really pushing the old age of a radio galaxy and seeing what happens to it at the end. The other reason that they're really interesting is that we can use them as probes of the cosmic web of structure in the universe around us, because they extend really far out into that structure. And we can use their emission passing through other things as a sort of a secondary probe, which is really exciting.
Absolutely incredible. And we were kind of you were talking about galaxy collisions during your talk. How is that relevant to the field?
Well, so giant radio galaxies and dragons, which are double radio sources associated with galactic nuclei, they're hosted by giant elliptical galaxies. And elliptical galaxies are formed by the collision of normal star-forming galaxies.
Okay, when two galaxies collide, does that mean that the stars within those galaxies collide themselves?
I don't know if they collide head on. They certainly interact, as does everything else. The gas, the dust, it all gets stripped off, and you get these huge tails of emission that stream behind colliding galaxies as the gravity sort of drags them around.
And is this the sort of thing that we can actually observe happening in real time?
Yeah, so we see this in several places in the universe. In fact, many places in the universe. You can observe it in lots of different wave bands. The radio is particularly good for looking at it because we can use the hydrogen line to see the tidal tails very clearly, and you get absolutely beautiful structures of galaxies pirouetting around each other.
And you work at the Jodrell Bank. So is there somewhere that our listeners can kind of find out more about this field?
Yeah, come and look at our website. Come and visit us. Jodrell Bank Discovery Centre is open all the time.
Thank you very much for speaking to me, Anna.
No problem.
So I have the great pleasure of being joined by a CERN scientist, Professor Chris Parks, who's the deputy spokesperson for the Large Hadron Collider BUD at CERN, as I said. Chris, thanks very much for joining me at Blue Dot.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I work with from the University of Manchester and also with CERN, as you say.
The reason that we're speaking really is because there's been some exciting news over the past few days. But I suppose before we get on to that, it'd be worth kind of touching upon the work that's actually done at CERN, because I think a lot of people, including myself, kind of struggle to understand what it is and why it's so important.
Yes, so at CERN we have a number of accelerators, but our largest one is the one which maybe your listeners have heard of before, the Large Hadron Collider, which is the most powerful particle accelerator operating in the world at the moment. It's a 27-kilometer long ring all the way around the circumference, and we collide protons that are going in one direction around the ring with protons that are going in the other direction around the ring at four points around the ring. And at these four points, we've got four large experiments, and we study the properties of the particles that are produced in the collisions of these protons. So one of the most famous things that has come out of the Large Hadron Collider that maybe some of your listeners are familiar with is the discovery of the Higgs boson, which was about 5 years ago now, almost exactly 5 years ago. But there are many other discoveries that are coming out of the Large Hadron Collider also.
And what's this latest discovery about?
So the latest discovery is of a particle which is called the Xi CC++. It's not a particularly snappy name, but it's a very interesting particle. It's a particle that's been long predicted, but we announced yesterday the discovery of this particle. Technically it's something called a baryon. A baryon is a particle that contains three quarks. So the most common examples of those are the proton and the neutron, which I guess most people are familiar with, which make up the nucleus of all our atoms. And this is another type of baryon. Like a proton or a neutron, it contains three quarks. But what's particularly special about this one is it's the first one that contains two heavier types of quarks. So all the normal matter around us is made of some light types of quarks. And this baryon that we found contains two of these heavier types of quarks. We already knew about some baryons which contained one type of quark. So if you like, the proton and neutron and its friends are the ground floor of a building. The first floor of the building contains these particles that have one heavy quark in them. And what we've just done is put the second floor on the building. So if you want, it's the penthouse proton.
And so how was this discovery made? Are you able to kind of go through that with us?
Yeah, certainly. So what happens in the Large Hadron Collider is that we collide protons. And really, at these energies, we're colliding the things of which the proton is made. So the proton is made of quarks, plus some things called gluons, and we're colliding those constituents. And out of that comes a whole array of new particles. Some of these particles only live for very short periods of time, such as this one that we've just discovered, but it then decays into other particles. And those particles fly through our detector, and our detector is composed of a number of different sections, and those different sections measure different properties of the particles. So by putting all this picture together about the information that we get of these particles flying through it, we can reconstruct the property of the original particle that was produced. So, for example, we can reconstruct what the mass is of this short-lived particle that then decayed into the other ones that we actually observe. And if we make a plot which shows the mass of the observations that we're making, we get a bump in this mass plot at the mass of this new particle.
Okay. I was at a talk earlier on today kind of talking about the square kilometre array, and one of the points they were made was that you could essentially divide the universe into three, and a very small, maybe 5% of it would be baryons, and that's basically what we can observe, and everything else is either dark matter or dark energy. So how does this discovery kind of affect that model, if at all?
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So this particle is firmly part of that baryonic matter that we actually see in the visible universe around us. But you're absolutely right. The evidence from the astrophysical astronomy experiments is that there is large components, other components of the energy in the universe. So one of them, as you mentioned, is dark matter. And dark matter is called dark matter because we haven't got a clue what it is. We don't actually know what particle is making up dark matter. So one of the hopes that might come out of the next runs of the Large Hadron Collider is that we actually find evidence for new particles, and that these new particles could actually be particles that could make up dark matter. Now, this one that we've just discovered today, yesterday, certainly isn't. The one that we've just discovered, it's part of normal baryonic matter. It's part of a state that would be predicted. But the sorts of experiments that we're doing at CERN are indeed looking for candidates for dark matter.
You said that the particle that has been discovered was previously theorized to
exist.
That's
right, yes.
So there must be other particles that we have theorized and that we are also looking for?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. And that's an interesting thing. If we go back to my analogy of this being the second floor in the building, indeed, this is the first particle in that second floor, but it will have friends and relations, and now we can hunt for those as well.
So how does it kind of affect your research? Is it kind of business as usual with regards to what you're doing at CERN, or is this kind of a game-changing epoch?
It's an interesting state, this new particle, because this new particle has properties which allow us to test our theories in a different way from previous particles that we have. So this particle, because it contains two heavy quarks, there's a nice analogy with binary stars, if you go to astronomy. In astronomy, you can have binary stars where you have two stars that are orbiting each other, and then you can have a planet which is orbiting those, which is only loosely bound to the binary star. And this is a little bit like a particle physics analogy at the complete other scale. It's two heavy quarks, so those are like your stars in the binary star system, and then you've got one light quark. Also. So it allows us to test our theory in ways in which the other baryons that we have from lower down in the building, to mix my analogies, don't allow us to. So the particular force that it's probing is a force which is called the strong force, and that's the force which holds the quarks together inside the proton and the neutron, inside the nucleus of the atoms.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's probably also worth touching on the standard model, because that's kind of something that this affects. I mean, can you explain what the standard model is and how this actually affects that?
Yes, the standard model is our underlying theory of particle physics. It has a set of particles in it, which are all the particles that we know about. And it has force carriers, which carry the fundamental forces. It includes the three out of the four fundamental forces that we know about, which are the strong force that I just mentioned. That's the one responsible for holding the quarks together. It includes something called the weak force, which is the one responsible for radioactive decay. And it includes the electromagnetic force, which people will be familiar with from electricity and light and all the electromagnetic effects that we know about. There is, of course, a fourth force, which it doesn't include, which is gravity. And that's the interesting mix between what we're doing in particle physics and what the astronomers are doing, where they're mostly probing things to do with gravitational force, and we're mostly probing things to do with the other three forces. And actually, theoretically, the two pictures are not well joined up together.
Mm. Yeah, because we still don't really know what gravity is, do we?
No, that's right. And from a particle physics point of view, this is very difficult to probe. From a particle physics point of view, we really probe the other three forces, which are the forces which have the highest strength at the small scale. At the large scale, then the other three forces are neutralized, and then gravity takes over. It's a much weaker force, but it's important, obviously, at the large-scale structure in astronomy. So there's a nice complementarity between what particle physicists do and what astronomers do. And, of course, ultimately, we would like a unified theory which joins up the whole picture. So we have this standard model in particle physics, which is an extremely well-tested theory, and where there was one particle that was missing from this standard model, and that was the Higgs boson that was discovered at the Large Hadron Collider. And the sort of states that I'm talking about, like the ZICC, are states where you take these fundamental particles from the standard model and you join them together in different ways. So, for example, the proton and the neutron are made by joining up some of these quarks in the standard model together. And the new particle that's been discovered is by taking other quarks in the from this standard model and joining them up in a different way.
So you could really say that we've kind of taken one more step to properly understanding the universe around us.
We're trying to probe these fundamental forces and test this underlying theory of the standard model by doing these experiments to test whether the particles behave in the way that we would expect them to from our theory. And of course, the big hope is that they don't, because then that tells us that our theory is missing something, that we need to add some new particles, need to add something else to our theory. And the hope is that maybe even some of these puzzles from astronomy are related to puzzles we have in particle physics, and that we could find the effects of some new particle, and that new particle could be involved with dark matter.
Incredible. Is it very exciting? Thank you very much for joining me and also for explaining it so well.
Been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm joined now by Mark McCorkran, Senior Advisor for Science and Exploration at ESA. Thanks very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
I just want to ask you the big question straight off. Where is the most exciting place in the solar system right now?
That's a really good question. You know, I mean, usually the question is asked, where's your favourite planet or something like that, to which my always answer is the one we're sitting on, right? I mean, all the others are very interesting and there's a huge amount to be learned from them, but there's this is the one we live on. So if you were to ask where's the most exciting place in the solar system today, you know, what's going on? We've got satellites around Mars. We've got two of them there at the moment. We've got missions elsewhere in the solar system. We have a lander sitting on a comet. We've got a spacecraft sitting on a comet, no longer operating. Most exciting place, it has to be sitting here with you, I suppose.
In terms of life on other planets, then, in that sense, where would it be?
Well, you know, the sort of conventional thinking, there's nothing wrong with that thinking, is that you follow the water to find life. And there are lots of places in the solar system where there's water. The Earth, obviously. Mars has a history of having had liquid water on the surface 3.5-4 billion years ago. And there's on the order of 1 million cubic kilometers of water ice under the surface. The other places which are really exciting in that regard are the icy moons, both of Jupiter and Saturn. And they have deep oceans under thick ice crusts. And in some cases, in particular Europa, for example, and maybe Enceladus, which Europa's around Jupiter and Enceladus around Saturn, they may be in contact with rock right at the base of the water ocean. And there may be even volcanism at the base of those oceans. So heat, which could then lead to mineral liberation and perhaps even, like on the Earth at the Black Smokers, maybe life there. But for me, in a weird sense, finding life on Mars, for example, there's the danger that it might actually be the same as life on Earth. Now, what do I mean by that? Mars and Earth are connected. They're connected by meteorites. by impacts of objects onto the surface of the Earth and Mars, you can actually spray material out into space, and that material later on will land on other locations in the solar system. So we have Martian meteorites, rocks which came from Mars, landed on the surface of the Earth. We already have Martian rocks. So there's at least that possibility that there was sharing of material from the early solar system. Maybe primordial life, you know, the very earliest kind of microbes, could have been shared between the planets. So we go to Mars to search for life. There is at least the possibility it will be just the same as the life we find on Earth, albeit evolved differently over time. So here's a real place where it might be different, though, and that's Titan.
How so?
So Titan is one of the moons of Saturn, and Titan has a very dense atmosphere, and that atmosphere is made of hydrocarbons, ethane and methane. And there's a kind of hydrological cycle on Titan. So you actually have seasonally, as Saturn goes around and changes its orientation with respect to the sun, you get seasons on Titan as well. So you have summer, you have autumn, you have winter, and you have spring. And there are times in that cycle where you see rain clouds moving across the surface of Titan. Rain falls to the surface, runs down little rivulets, gathers in seas, oceans, but not of water, of liquid hydrocarbons. So incredibly cold, but still liquid. And the question is, could we conceive of life forms which might actually have evolved in that very different physical environment? And that would, you know, by definition, be incredibly different to the life we have on Earth. So there are many people who would actually really like to go and look for life on Titan.
Because it would be so different.
It would be so different. And philosophically, what's important about that, again, is, you know, if you do find life on Mars and it turns out to be the same as life on Earth in its origin, that's, of course, exciting. But it doesn't answer the fundamental question about life, which is, can it form twice in the universe independently? That's the big question. Because if twice within the same solar system you can get what we call life, reproducing systems, then it means it must be everywhere. It must be easy to do it elsewhere in the universe.
Now, all that being said, I wanted to touch on one of ESA's upcoming major missions, which is Bepi Colombo, heading back to Mercury. And it feels like for years we've been pushing outwards, ever since Voyager, and then, you know, major projects in the past, say Rosetta spacecraft, would keep going outwards. And now we're looking back. And Mercury certainly isn't a place where you naturally expect life, so what's the draw?
Well, there's many other things to be learned about the solar system other than just life alone. The reason we haven't been to Mercury very often, there's only been two spacecraft that have been to Mercury in the past, Mariner 10 in the 1970s and NASA's Messenger in the 2000s. And the reason is it's actually harder to get to the inner solar system than it is to get even to Pluto, because it's all about energetics. It's all about rockets. You would think you might be able to slide downhill towards the sun very nicely, use the gravity, the pull of the sun to get you down towards Mercury. You could, but you wouldn't be able to stop when you got there.
You just fly straight.
You go straight past. So you've actually got to get to Mercury. You could get there in 3 months if you did what's called a Hohmann transfer orbit. You basically put a big thrust at the beginning to put you on an elliptical orbit, which then has its highest point from the sun where we are and its lowest point by Mercury, effectively. You could do that, but when you got there, then you'd have to use a huge amount of thrust to slow down again. And that means a bigger rocket than we have, and you'd have no spacecraft on the top of it. So the way we're going to do it, and the way everybody has done it in the past, is actually use flybys of other planets. The Earth once, Venus twice, and Mercury itself 6 times. Now, that doesn't just mean going next to it and flying past it like you're in orbit. It means going whizzing past it and then going in orbit around the sun and letting Mercury catch up with you, doing it again, slowing down a bit, doing it again, and doing it 6 times until you then finally, at the very end, use a little bit of a chemical rocket and put yourself into orbit around Mercury. So it's incredibly difficult to get to Mercury, which is why we haven't been there many times. But it is nevertheless very exciting as a planet. If you think about the sort of big question, how did the solar system form? How was it born? You've got to create a model which ends up reproducing what we see today. And what's often hardest in models is to reproduce the extremes, the things which are furthest away and the things which are closest in, the highest temperatures, the lowest temperatures. And Mercury is the nearest planet to the sun. It's the hottest one on the surface without the greenhouse effect of Venus, which makes it hotter, but naturally hottest planet. And it's weird. It has a magnetic field. It shouldn't. It shouldn't have a magnetic field at all. A solid iron core, it should be solid by now. It should have frozen. It's a small world, only 40% the size of the Earth. And yet, it seems to be liquid on the interior, generating a dynamo, generating a magnetic field. How the hell does that happen?
Now, you mentioned those difficult environments, and I think one of the things you said in your talk was it's a good place to cook a pizza.
Well, yeah, this is one of the huge challenges. The challenge getting there is really difficult. And just let me say, you know, we not only use the flybys, we also use ion engines, which use xenon gas. You strip the electrons off, and then you accelerate with a high electric field. You accelerate the xenon ions out the back and use that as a thruster. Well, those will be on for 2 years out of the seven-year journey to help us. But once you even get there, then Mercury's really hard work, because on one side of you, you have the Sun, and you're a third of the distance, roughly, from the Earth to the Sun once you get to Mercury. That makes the Sun roughly 10 times brighter. And so you've got that incredibly intense solar flux on one side of your spacecraft. And on the other side, you have Mercury filling your sky. And Mercury, at its hottest, at midday at the equator, gets up to 430 degrees centigrade. And that's the pizza oven. You know, if, as I said in my talk, if you have if you turn your ordinary oven up to 200, and you're not even close to what it takes to cook a Neapolitan pizza. 450 degrees is what you're trying to achieve. But that problem is you've got heat on one side, heat on the other. And you've got to maintain the interior of your spacecraft down to 50 degrees centigrade.
And how are you managing to achieve that?
Well, you draw the heat away through what are called heat pipes. There's no convection. There's no atmosphere to take it away. So you run pipes with liquid ammonia, and they run along the side electronics. Then you take that, it's warmed up, you take it to what we call radiators, and it's the same as a radiator in your house, where it effectively is a warm liquid giving off heat, and we radiate that into space. But if we radiate it towards the Sun, that's pointless. There's a big hot thing giving us energy back. If we radiate it towards Mercury, big hot thing giving it back. So we actually have to radiate into a very narrow range of angles between the Sun on one side and Mercury on the other. So that gap in between, looking down away from both objects. So our radiators are really weird. They're mirrors on one side, which try to reflect the sunlight and Mercury light. On the other side, well, you would think they would be black, you know, the best color for radiating. In fact, they're white, matte white, because that still, it looks black in the infrared, which is what matters. That's where you're giving the heat away. So we have an incredibly complex system for managing the thermal environment of the spacecraft. You know, living in the pizza oven, how do you stay cool? And we think we've cracked it.
So just, we talked about the spacecraft. Once BepiColombo arrives at Mercury, what are big questions you hope it's going to answer?
Well, the one I mentioned before about this magnetic field, which was discovered by Mariner 10, back 74, 75. Why is that? What is there? What's special about the core? What's wrong with our models? And one option possibly is there's sulfur in the core, which might effectively change the melting point of iron so that it is still liquid at the lower temperatures. So there's that, and we'll be measuring that with two spacecraft, our European Mercury planetary orbiter, which has magnetically sensitive instruments on board, and our partner spacecraft, the Japanese Mercury magnetospheric orbiter. So we'll be in different orbits, and we'll be sampling the magnetic field, trying to work out what the structure is, and trying to probe the interior as well by measuring the gravitational attraction of Mercury. We have very sensitive gravity sensors on board. And as we fly past Mercury, it'll tell us what the structure of the interior is. So we're really trying to probe inside without drilling a hole and looking. And then you have the surface. And the surface is much like the surface of our moon. It's got craters from things hitting it. It's got mare, what we call the seas on the moon, which are actually flooded lava plains. And it seems to have some very low volcanoes, which aren't active today, but may have been in the past. And then there are weird places which look like sort of crumpled up surface structure, hollows full of slightly weird volatile materials, things that should have disappeared from the heat of the sun. Are they coming out from under the crust and still filling these little craters up? Or is it residual material from having been hit by comets and asteroids landing on the surface and it hasn't all been burned away yet? So there's a lot we don't know about Mercury, even with the previous two missions having studied it.
Launch in October 2018?
That's the plan at the
and
moment.
And then a seven-year journey, is that right?
Seven and a half, yes. Seven and a quarter. So, yeah.
Hopefully we might get some of the answers to these questions around 2025?
Exactly. We're scheduled to arrive, if we launch nominally 5th of October next year, And of course, you can't launch any random day towards Mercury because you've got to have all the planets lined up that you're going to use for these flybys. So if we don't make it for October, and we're on schedule, so we don't think a problem, the next one would be April in the following year. So there's quite a long delay. So yes, if we launch in October 2018, we get there in December 2025. We will have been past Mercury a few times, so we'll have done some science along the way. But we don't go into orbit until 2025. So yes, I hate to say it, it just doesn't seem possible, but I will be retired by that point. So I'll be watching from a bath chair somewhere, you know.
You're keeping tabs on that.
Well, I hope so. I hope so, yes.
Finally, one last thing I wanted to ask you on a tangent was, in the light of the Brexit vote, what does that mean for the European Space Agency?
In a formal sense, there's no link between the European Union as a structure and European Space Agency. We have 22 member states in ESA, so that's fewer than are in the EU, but two of our member states are not EU members, Norway and Switzerland. So we're largely overlapping structures, but not in any formal way. So in that sense, it doesn't affect us. There are two programs in ESA, however, which are directly funded by the EU. We're effectively the agency building things. And one of those is the Galileo system. And these are new navigation satellites. So everybody knows GPS. Galileo is effectively an upgraded European version of that. And we are building and flying those and operating them for the European Union. And once the UK... if it does leave, and who knows at this point, if it does leave the European Union, then that, the relationship with that system, and in particular the industries which are building those satellites, they're actually being built in the UK at the moment. So where does the UK go if, or that industry go, if the UK is no longer part of the EU paying for them? They won't be able to get the contracts, at least you would think. And the other system we have is a system called Copernicus. And Copernicus is a series of Earth observation satellites, so monitoring the Earth's environment, salinity of the oceans, the water moisture in the atmosphere, the speed of wind, that kind of... It's useful data in between meteorology satellites and a pure science satellite. And European Union pays for that as well. So in that sense, that poses problems for those two programs.
Hopefully, regardless of what happens, we can have more of those collaborative projects and more successes we've seen with Rosetta, Gaia, and the like.
Well, in the near term, the missions we've picked in our program, European Space Agency, go out to 2034. We have a whole slate of missions. The UK is a strong, important part of the European Space Agency. And, you know, as a Brit, I say that, but I say that because I see it every day. What British industry does, what British scientists do is vital. But, you know, that kind of... some of the funding comes from the EU for the science that is exploited from our missions. We don't pay for that, but the EU does. So where does that leave the UK? So there is a good future ahead, but I'm worried.
Mark McCochrane, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking to me.
So that's all from us at the Blue Dot Festival here at Jodrell Bank. Thanks to everyone who took the time out to speak to us. It's been a busy weekend, and obviously thanks to everyone who organised the festival and made it possible.
It's been fantastic, hasn't it?
Yeah, Kev, what was your highlight, would you say?
Oh, mine was from Mark McCochrane's talk. Mark McCochrane from ESA. He was telling us about Comet 67P, and they found this this cliff 100 metres high, and because the gravity is so much less... on 67P and Earth, if you were to jump off that, like base jumping, it would take you 20 minutes to get to the bottom, almost safe. I thought that was great. It was a nice little nugget of fact.
And the pixies were good as well.
Oh my God, they weren't they just. if you would like to know more about the Blue Dot Festival, you can visit their website, which is discovertheblue.com. If you would like to hear more from BBC Sky Night Magazine, you can go to our website, www.skynightmagazine.com, or by our print and digital editions. That's all from us.
Yep, it's been good.
Thanks for listening.